Welcome to the Science Podcast for February 22nd, 2013. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, the cost-effectiveness of HIV treatment, nuclear testing in North Korea, and preserving plant diversity, one seed at a time.
We can dry them out. We can put them at really cold temperatures. We can heat them up. So they're extremely durable, but they're not rocks.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
In South Africa, about 5.5 million people are living with HIV. And since 2004, a large percentage of the infected population has started taking antiretroviral therapy. These drugs, also known as ARTs, curb both the illness and the likelihood of disease transmission. In a report this week, Jacob Bohr and colleagues show that ART is also a cost-effective measure, calculating that the survival benefits exceeded the cost of treatment 26 times over.
Our paper assesses the population-level changes in adult life expectancy in a rural South African community with very high HIV prevalence. Following the 2004 scale-up of HIV treatment in public sector clinics and hospitals, we find that life expectancy has increased by over 11 years. These data were collected by the Africa Center for Health and Population Studies, a research center funded by the Wellcome Trust and affiliated with the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Data were collected on over 100,000 adults for over 12 years, and I just point out the scale of this undertaking because I wish to acknowledge the contributions of the entire staff of the Africa Center, as well as many respondents who gave their time to the research.
Well, so can you give us a brief overview of HIV in South Africa? How did the infection rates and life expectancy change beginning in the 1990s?
HIV actually came relatively late to South Africa compared to the rest of the continent. As early as 1990, just 1% of pregnant women in the country were HIV positive. Mm-hmm. But during the 90s, the epidemic really exploded. By 1998, a quarter of pregnant women in South Africa were HIV positive. Mm-hmm. And the scale of the epidemic that emerged in South Africa and in the surrounding countries of Botswana, Lesotho, and Swaziland was really of a scale different than the rest of sub-Saharan Africa and the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. As a result of this increase in HIV, there was a very large reduction in adult life expectancy during the 1990s of over a decade, almost 20 years in some cases. And this was really a reduction in adult life expectancy that was unprecedented in modern history, with the exception of large wars and famine.
Other estimates of life expectancy in this context have come out before. What sets your group's count apart from those?
So our study has two important features that distinguish it from previous work in this setting. First, we assess changes in adult life expectancy at the population level rather than for individual HIV patients. Mm-hmm. Doing so implies that we capture the full range of HIV patient experiences, regardless of clinical loss to follow-up, because we still observe people in this population surveillance system. We also capture any spillover effects that ART scale-up may have on non-HIV mortality or mortality rates for people not on ART. Second, instead of relying on assumptions necessary in modeling approaches, we directly measure dates of death and exposure time for a complete population cohort. This allows us to assess rapidly changing age-specific mortality rates that are occurring in this community.
You didn't do sampling. You actually counted everyone.
We counted everyone. As I mentioned before, this is a massive, massive research undertaking. Mm-hmm. So the Africa Center collects twice a year data from every single household in this geographically defined area in rural KwaZulu-Natal. We had over 101,000 adults in our survey contributing over 600,000 person years of follow-up. And over this period, we observed 13,000 deaths.
And how many of the people in the study sample actually have HIV?
So HIV prevalence among adults ages 15 to 49 is 29%.
And how many of them, what percentage of your HIV cohort were on ARTs in the study period?
By 2011, over a third of people with HIV in the cohort have initiated ART. And that includes adults of all ages, so 15 and up.
So let's get into these results that you found. You mentioned that there was an increase in life expectancy. Can you give us a little bit more detail about what you found?
Certainly. So we assessed adult life expectancy from 2000 to 2011. And between 2000 and 2003, there was a steady and significant decline in adult life expectancy. But beginning in 2004, when ART began to be scaled up in this community, life expectancy began to rise. And so in 2003, adult life expectancy was 49 years. And by 2011, life expectancy had increased to 60 and a half years, over an 11-year gain. What's really stunning to us is this massive shift in the distribution of ages at death from people in young adulthood to people in older ages. And it's quite clear that that's what's driving this increase in life expectancy. But we also find evidence of continued excess mortality due to HIV at these younger ages. And so even with these very large gains in adult life expectancy, we expect that with further scale-up of treatment and improved retention in care, that we'll be able to accomplish even further gains in adult life expectancy going into the future.
So let's switch gears a bit. In your article, you do some economic analysis of the cost of treatment with ARTs versus the economic value of the changes in survival at the population level. How do these costs compare?
So one question of interest to policymakers is you have these survival gains, but how much did they cost? Mm-hmm. To look at that question, we assessed the total number of life years lived in the community between 2004, when ART began to be scaled up, and 2011. And we compared that number to the number of life years that would have occurred in the community during this period had the 2003 mortality schedule persisted over time. We then compare that to the total costs of administering this program, which we estimate using published data on costs of providing ART in the South African setting, and multiply that by the directly observed person time of patients on ART treatment or in pre-ART HIV care. What we find is a cost-effectiveness ratio of about $1,500 per life year saved. A cost-effectiveness ratio of $1,500 per life year means that it costs $1,500 in order to save a year of life in this community. That's not very much. $1,500 is a quarter of annual per capita GDP in South Africa. And the commonly used benchmark and cost-effective analysis are that an intervention is cost-effective if it's less than three times GDP. Mm-hmm. It's very cost-effective if it's less than one times per capita GDP. Mm-hmm. And this is less than a quarter of per capita GDP, indicating that it's an extremely cost-effective intervention and one that should really continue to be pursued.
Well, let's put this in a bigger policy picture. So what are the policy implications of these findings? Can these data help guide where to spend money for public health, for example?
Most importantly, we're showing for the first time the incredibly large population level gains in survival that can occur as a result of ART scale-up in HIV endemic settings. We're measuring this for ART programs in a real-life setting. In a real-life setting where retention is incomplete, where adherence is incomplete, in a sort of a warts-and-all scenario. And even in that case, ART programs can have a huge impact on population-level life expectancy. Having established that for these gains to persist in the future, it's going to require sustained financial and political commitment to ART programs, both to maintain existing patients on treatment for the duration of their lives, and to providing access to treatment for all of those who need it. Rising life expectancy in this context, though, may have other impacts on quality of life in this setting. It may have impacts on mental health in this setting. It may have impacts on investment decisions of individuals and households. For example, if I know that I'm likely to live until pension age rather than having a high risk of death in my 40s, I may be much more likely to go to school, go to college, do job training programs. This may have important impacts on the way that people invest in themselves and in their futures. It also has important implications for governments thinking about where to devote resources. I think this study really confirms that ART can be implemented through public sector treatment programs effectively, and that it's really a slam dunk of an intervention in this regard. I think one of the important aspects of these findings for South Africa is that for many years, South Africa was criticized for its delay in rolling out ART. And a lot of that criticism was justified. But really, since 2004, South Africa has been a model in rolling out ART to achieve very high coverage levels and quite rapidly. And the fruits of that government commitment to this treatment program are documented in this paper.
Well, Jacob Bohr, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Jacob Bohr and colleagues write about the cost of ART in a report this week. Be sure to check out a related report by Frank Tanzer and colleagues on HIV transmission and a News Focus by John Cohn. Hi, podcast listeners. This week's show is sponsored by Audible.com, and they're offering a special deal to Science listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And in case you're having difficulty deciding, we thought we'd give you a few recommendations. So I went with Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fates of Human Societies by Jared Diamond. It's a slightly controversial way to learn about the evolution of civilization and warfare. So what about you, Sarah?
Well, Carrie, my pick is Mary Roach's Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers. She's great at coming up with a perfect combination of engrossing and gross.
Sounds like it. So podcast listeners, check out these books and more from Audible. And don't forget to get your free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. The Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, or CTBT, bans all nuclear explosions, including tests, by its member states. It was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly in 1996, but it is not yet in full force, because many countries, including the United States and North Korea, haven't ratified it. Recent developments in North Korea have spurred further debate about this treaty. Deputy News Editor Richard Stone spoke with a member of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization, or CTBTO, about what happened, and he gave me a little context for what it means scientifically and politically.
On February 12th, North Korea conducted a nuclear test. The test has provoked strong international reaction, condemnation, and countries are now deciding how to respond, what kind of measures that ought to be taken in response to the nuclear test. The Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization has a monitoring system in place that will one day be used to verify nations adhering to the treaty. Now, the CTBTO monitoring network picked up seismic signals from the test, and we were able to conclude that it was a magnitude 5.1 earthquake triggered by the test. Now, many questions remain. What kind of nuclear material, fissile material, was used for the bomb? Was it plutonium or was it uranium? The answers to that question may come from radionuclide detection, radionuclides such as radioxenon that may have escaped from the test site. I had the chance to catch up with Dr. Lasina Zerbo, the director of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization's International Data Center Division, at the AAAS annual meeting in Boston last week. I talked with Dr. Zerbo about the potential for detecting radioxenon and the implications that that would hold. So I thought we would start with the North Korean test. It's a presumed test, of course, because as far as I know, the radionuclides, radioxenon emissions have not yet been detected from the test site. Is that true?
That's true. As of today, we still haven't detected any sign of radionuclide xenon gas that could be the correlating factor for member states to make the final decision on the nature of the test.
Of course, it's implausible that it would be anything but nuclear because of the yield of the test. If you cannot detect any radioxenon but have an opportunity in the future for an on-site inspection, what could be seen, for example, months from now on the test site? There are other radionuclides of interest, such as argon. Could that kind of element still be present, say, months from now?
Yeah, indeed. If we were to conduct on-site inspection, I think between 4 to 6 months, there are other isotopes that would be relevant, and then that could be detected by the on-site inspection technology, and argon is one of them, as you mentioned. One of the critical factors is the ratio between the xenon-135 and 135M. Okay, that's what is critical. And it would have been better to see sniff of those isotopes. But if we don't have those, you can still detect the 135M, but not together with the 135 to be able to see what ratio you have. That's what makes the timing a little bit critical. But after that, indeed, 4 to 6 months would be key in detecting others like argon.
Now, the seismic waveforms that you picked up from the test, it's been very useful to determine that the third nuclear test took place at the same site as the first two tests. How challenging is it to reconstruct the yield of the test based on the seismic signal?
I've mentioned several times to journalists that the yield is not a standard product of the CTBT. But indeed, you know, when you deal with scientists, they have their own curiosity. But this is not a product that we distribute to our member state. Having said this, what I can say, when you look at the three ANOS tests by the DPRK, the 2006, the 2009, and then the one a couple of weeks ago, you would see that in terms of amplitude, or you know, how large is the event. We're talking in 2009 of 4.5 body wave magnitude, and then this time 4.9 body wave. So if you take 0.3 to 0.4 in a logarithmic scale, you're talking about twice as much as the event that happened in 2009. So if you consider that the media and then the different national technical media, we're talking about a kiloton for the 2009, from what we're hearing from the news and then from the different media and from the different institutions, people are roughly talking of a yield between 5 to 7 TNT equivalent. That's what we gather from the scientific institution outside our framework.
There's been some debate over how long it may take for the states to fully ratify the CTBT. Do you foresee a day that the CTBT will actually be ratified in force? And how would that change the operation?
If we aren't into force, the operation change drastically. I mean, it would be working 24-7. Right now, we're monitoring 24-7, but the office is not manned 24-7. So that would be a big change. So having said this, let's talk about President Obama's speech in Prague. He had endeavored to pursue the CTBT ratification by the Senate. And then that has raised a momentum 2 years ago or a couple of years ago to getting the annex two country, the eight remaining one, to ratify. Indeed, if the U.S. does ratify, it will change the political realm significantly, I would say, because then we'll have countries like China who are remaining, and then Israel and Egypt, India and Pakistan, North Korea, Iran. So those are the countries that are remaining in terms of ratification. One would assume that having the P5, when I say P5, we talk about the non-official nuclear power countries. There are two of them remaining, so if all five of them could ratify, I think it will set up a good framework for the ratification of the remaining. I mean, we're hopeful that this is something that is in the pipeline, and then indeed with the recent announcement of the DPRK, I think that will probably serve as a wake-up call to the international community to pursuing the CTBT ratification, because it's all linked to the world peace and security, and then we're remaining hopeful that this would happen.
So much of your interview with Dr. Szerbo centered around what we, the external world, could determine about this explosion. What has and hasn't North Korea officially stated about this event?
North Korea has announced that they conducted a nuclear test, and most significantly, that it was a device that was smaller and lighter than their previous tests. So that would imply to experts that they have made progress in miniaturizing their bomb design, which is particularly alarming because currently the North Korean nuclear program does not pose a strategic threat to the U.S. They have no means to deliver a nuclear warhead to the U.S. If they were able to miniaturize a bomb such that they can put it on a rocket, a long-range rocket, then it becomes a much more serious and dangerous threat.
And would North Korea have any obligation to allow scientists from elsewhere an on-site inspection?
They have no legal obligation at all. They have not ratified the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. They withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So there's no legal obligation, and there's no chance in the foreseeable future for inspectors to go on the ground in North Korea.
So not being able to go and actually do an on-site inspection, how would we be able to determine what kind of fissile material was used?
It's very difficult and maybe impossible. The window of opportunity that they had really has closed. You have to determine the ratio of radioxenon isotopes, specifically radioxenon-135 versus radioxenon-133. 135 has a half-life of only 9 hours. So if you had not been able to establish the ratio within a couple days, basically, according to experts in the civilian area, you don't have much hope of determining the nature of the fissile material.
Now, were the U.S. and some of the other bigger nuclear powers to ratify the CTBT, how would the treaty organization have responded to this explosion? You know, how could the treaty have been enforced?
A country that ratifies the treaty agrees to not test nuclear weapons. So it's a comprehensive ban. There's no provision for testing. That means that countries that wanted to evade their treaty obligations would try to conduct a test secretly. And that's not the case with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
North Korea openly declared this test. They wanted it to be as convincing as possible. They had no interest in trying to minimize the seismic signal from the test. So almost the CTBT provisions don't apply here. However, the fact that the verification system has been built up in expectation that the CTBT will someday come into force, that's been a huge boon because you can learn a lot from the North Korean nuclear tests from the existing data monitoring system that the CTBT has put into place.
Great. Well, Rich Stone, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Richard Stone and Lucina Zerbo spoke with me about North Korea and the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. You can read the full story in a news article this week.
As plant diversity dwindles under the pressures of farming, climate change, and population growth, seed banks, cold storage for the world's plant diversity, are facing a different diversity problem. Not all seeds can survive deposition in their vaults. I spoke with Christina Walters, one of the authors of a perspective this week that argues for an increased variety of preservation techniques in order to keep up with plant diversity.
What we're working on is ex situ conservation. Ex situ means bringing plants out of their natural habitat and putting them into a very artificial environment. But the advantage of that is that we can capture hundreds of thousands of individuals as seeds and put them in a suspended animation and keep them alive for a very long time. And that allows us to buy time and reintroduce the plants later. So that's what ex situ conservation is doing, and it's a very inexpensive way to achieve some conservation goals.
So what is the time scale here? How long can seeds stay in storage and still be viable?
Well, that's a really good question. In orthodox seeds, these are seeds that can dry down and we put them in the freezer just like a freezer in your house. Mm-hmm. We're expecting most seeds to survive more than 100 years.
Oh.
There's a lot of error in that and a lot of uncertainty, but at least 100 years. It gets much harder if you can't freeze the seeds, and that's the problem with these recalcitrant seeds.
I tend to think of seeds as pretty durable. You can order them on the internet, store them on a shelf for a couple years. What makes a seed recalcitrant?
Well, first of all, let's go to your question about seeds being durable. That's how I got my PhD. It's a lot of people think of seeds as rocks. They
yeah.
don't do anything. And that's the most amazing part of them. And that's why I studied them as a PhD student, is they don't really exhibit much of the signs of life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't grow, they don't metabolize, they don't reproduce, but they are alive, and therefore they are not rocks. So you might be thinking of them as durable, but I look at them as living entities. Perhaps they can take a lot more stress than you and I can do. So, I mean, I call that extreme biology. We can dry them out, we can put them at really cold temperatures, we can heat them up. So they're extremely durable, but they're not rocks. A recalcitrant seed is more like you and me. It can't take those levels of stress.
What are some examples of stressors that act on these unorthodox seeds much more strongly than on an orthodox seed?
Well, recalcitrance is an anthropogenic term. It's based completely on that we can't store them.
Okay.
So we can't take them and put them in the ex situ context. They do just fine where they live. They've evolved that way. So the stressors are low temperature and low moisture.
Okay, so they're good at what they're supposed to do, but they're not good for storage.
They're annoying to human beings who want to put them in storage. That's right.
Okay, so do these seeds make up a big proportion of plants?
About 25% of angiosperms produce recalcitrant seeds or non-orthodox.
Can you give us some examples of these unorthodox seeds?
Okay. Most of all, the tropical fruits that you like to eat are recalcitrant. So if it's avocado, a citrus relative, chocolate, cacao is recalcitrant, mangoes, lychees, mostly anything that's tropical. Then we can also do tree species like oaks. Most of the oaks are all recalcitrant.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the methods that can be used for storing unorthodox seeds?
Most of the methods that we know are liquid nitrogen storage, so just cryogenic storage.
So why do they survive better under liquid nitrogen conditions or cryogenic conditions than they do, say, just in the freezer box?
Putting something in the freezer, and that's at minus 20 degrees centigrade, is really stressful because most biological organisms have water in it. So if the water freezes, we're dead. The secret to liquid nitrogen storage is not just getting it at that low temperature, it's how you get it at that low temperature. We already know that there's all kinds of cryogenic storage for embryos and sperm and animal materials. But we're talking about plants. And the same principles apply. You got to get these hydrated materials into a really low temperature without having the ice freeze. It's got to be a low temperature, so it's got to be below minus 130 degrees. And you could probably go lower. But you've got to do it, and you've got to do it fast enough that ice doesn't form.
Okay. Is seed storage really the best way to capture and preserve plant diversity? What about saving DNA or keeping plants alive in parks and preserves?
Well, seed storage definitely is a good ex situ strategy. There are others. I'll start with growing them or keeping them in parks, and we would call that in situ. And to preserve that, you'd have to have a lot of real estate. I mean, it takes an awful lot of land to keep the population of a tree species alive. So you'd have to have good relationships with the country that you're trying to work with. If you're looking at a tropical species, the United States isn't in the tropics. And so the responsibility for that in situ conservation really relies on the person who owns the land or the entity that owns the land. We don't have that. But even still, there's so much social pressure in the lands that have these natural wild species that really what ex situ conservation is doing is buying time. It's trying to save the genetic diversity of the material, not just saving the species. So we don't need a relic species, one or two items, to say that we've saved the species. What we really want is the genetic diversity so that the species can survive and evolve in its native environment. So that's the part about why not in situ.
Right.
Yes, definitely do in situ, but do ex situ as well. The part about storing DNA, boy, there's an awful lot of talk about storing DNA, but DNA isn't alive. It's just a molecule. And what we want is what's called germplasm. And that means something that is alive and you can grow a plant out of it. You can't grow a plant out of isolated DNA. Not only that, it's really expensive and the quality may vary. It may change. Seeds are really an ideal packaging for DNA. So you're saving money and you're getting a living entity. And you can also look at all the other chemical constituents within the seed and get some idea of how the seed grew. I mean, there's much, much more information associated with the seed than an isolated molecule.
Right. In your perspective, you mentioned ongoing research into seed storage. What are some of the big questions right now?
Oh, gosh, we have a lot of really good questions. I like that question. I think one of the big questions for, say, the agricultural industry, and that's really where I'm from, is what is seed quality? And why would you have two seeds that are genetically identical that behave so differently? Is it how the moms grew in the field? Is it how you harvest it? So understanding elements of seed quality is very important for the seed industry, and knowing whether or not they can save the seed for another year or they have to market it now because it's going to deteriorate fast. So that's a really big question in agriculture. I think another question is the evolutionary advantage of having seeds that have different storage behaviors. Why would a seed from the tropics tend to be more recalcitrant than a seed that would overwinter in a temperate area? What are the advantages? And if we understood that, what does the seed that is overwintering have that the seed that can't survive the stress doesn't have? And can we bottle that?
Right.
And can we make other things longer living too? You know, and so the technology can expand to organ preservation and some of the bigger tissues that we can't really cryopreserve, but if we can understand how they dry, we can do a huge amount of good for humans.
Wow. All right. Well, Chris Walters, thanks so much.
Great.
Christina Walters and colleagues write about banking the world's plant diversity in this week's Science. And that concludes the February 22nd, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.